Hi everyone, I'm Sarah Higgins, Art Papers Executive and Artistic Director. Art Papers expands the dialogue around contemporary art and culture by exploring the ways they affect and reflect human experience. You can find a rich archive of interviews, reviews, feature essays, artist projects, and more on artpapers.org. Welcome to this month's episode of Echoes, a monthly series where we spotlight our community of writers and artists who've been central to Art Papers' creative and rigorous coverage over the years. This month, we have a dialogue between Elvia Wilk and Sasha Cordingley, discussing their contributions to the winter 2022 issue, Other Species. The works they're discussing are linked in the description, and there's also a link if you'd like to support the work of Art Papers by making a donation or purchasing from our shop.
Hey, Elvia, we did it.
We did it. What's up?
We figured it out. How are you doing?
Good. It's nice to see you.
Nice to see you, too.
I have like a room in my co-working space with padded walls.
Excellent. So if you say anything embarrassing, nobody will hear.
I can hear everything they're saying. That's safe. But I do look like I'm an institution.
Yeah, it does look a little bit sanitary in there, which maybe is adept for what we're talking about today.
Exactly. Where are you?
I'm in Brooklyn. I'm in Bushwick, Bed-Stuy, kind of like on the border in my house. Where are you?
I'm in Crown Heights, so we could actually be doing this in person.
Yeah. I definitely wouldn't enjoy the trek over to Crown Heights from here, I'll say that. okay, maybe should we start? I think we have enough people. Okay, hi everybody. Welcome to Art Papers Contributors Conversations. It's a series of discussions between recent and past contributors to Art Papers. My name is Sasha, and I contributed a review of Cora Great Aruna Nanchai and Alex Vojic's Prey, which was at Canal Projects in New York. And I'm going to be talking today with Elvia Wilk and about both of our contributions to the recent issue of Art Papers, which was Other Species. This issue, as well as past issues and subscriptions, are available for purchase on artpapers.org. And our contributions are also available for free online, where Art Papers also regularly publishes online exclusive content. If you want to keep up to date on Art Papers content and events, you can sign up for our weekly newsletter at artpapers.org. And also keep in mind that we'll have time for questions at the end, so have them ready at that time. Elvia, do you want to maybe talk a bit about your contribution to this issue?
Yeah. Thanks for doing all the introductions.
Yes.
I'm really glad to have the chance to talk to you. I really loved your review and the issue, and I'm glad to get to know your work this way. I'm Elvia, for everyone else. I wrote a piece for this issue of Art Papers, which the issue is themed Other Species, like Sasha said. And my piece was something called a glossary entry, which is just pick a term and define it. And I chose the word parasite and wrote a little bit about parasites as a concept and a being, I guess. And it's important to say that those are different, and that I guess what I am saying in a very brief way in this piece is that what we use parasites as a shorthand for, which is an unequal or sort of a relationship that's disadvantageous for one party and advantageous for the other. Mm-hmm. Most parasites in the wild are really like, as far as we know, but there's a lot of parasite diversity, which we can get into. I was curious if we could talk a little bit about like the, because my piece is kind of like a general meditation on a term, and mm-hmm. yours is very specifically tied to an exhibition mm-hmm. that was held in New York. I was wondering if we could talk a little bit about that exhibition, and then maybe we could weave our own writing approaches and practices, and I guess like the things that we chose to pick up on in our pieces, we can sort of
sure.
like, directly what was on the show.
Yeah. So maybe I'll just start with the kind of descriptor of the show. It was an I consider it like an kind of immersive experience, an installation which consisted of a lot of different components. So there was two main videos, I think, which a lot of the which the exhibition centrals on, and both of those videos, Songs for Dying, Songs for Living, were intrinsically tied to each other, and they spoke to processes of becoming and decomposition and the new forms of life which arise out of them. It was, they do this on a personal and a kind of communal level, and it was particularly personal in Songs for Dying, which was a video downstairs in a very dark space in Canal Projects, which was made in response to the death of Cora Crit's grandfather, whose hands also had been cast, and in the exhibition space upstairs, they plucked the surface of a pond, which was in the middle of the gallery space, and this plucking I kind of equated to like a drawing out of histories, shared, personal, and fiction, and that kind of, those kind of themes are brought up a lot in both of the video pieces, and I think it was particularly important to highlight the expansion of personal histories into shared histories, since, you know, I think just like human and non-human life, where we're entangled in this cycle of living and dying, you know, government processes, political movements similarly are birthed and die, right? And kind of like flicker throughout time, in like a non-linear way. And yeah, I think the format of those videos also kind of spoke to that cycle, which didn't have a beginning or an end. Yeah. But those are, I think those are the two things that I focus on most with the videos. But besides that, there were also spirit houses, which lined one side of the gallery. And inside of them, they're quite small. They're probably about the size a little bit bigger than my head, all on podiums. They're kind of glowing like this little ember, and traditionally inside of them are offerings to a spirit, which is keeping a space safe. And these ones actually were usually they're edible offerings, but here they weren't necessarily edible. They were like little miniature animals and bones and vessels and jars, and I think you could equate that to like some type of ritual or ceremony between life and death. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, the first thing I thought of when I was reading your review of the show was the relationship between interspecies life and intergenerational life that the video make. I didn't get to see it in the space, which is a shame, but I've seen parts of the videos. And I guess my impression of them was that sort of the first video, Songs for Living, is sort of has a lot more to do with like plant and animal life, mm-hmm. and the one down, Songs for Dying, is a sort of a meditation on the passing of one person as well as the passing of political movements over time. So is it? Does it seem to you that the videos are separated by species, like that the downstairs video is about humans, mm-hmm. there's one that's about non-humans?
I don't necessarily, actually, yeah, maybe you could say that. I mean, the upstairs video, I actually don't necessarily think it had much to do with humans as more a way of life or like a way of being, and not tethered to like any type of species specifically. But the downstairs one really was about like reciprocity among species, I think. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's kind of the distinction that I think would be made between the two, although they do reference each other a lot, and there are like ecosystems. I think the ecosystems are found, there's an ocean ecosystem and like a water ecosystem, which is found in both of those, and I think kind of enlivened both of them. Yeah, and that's kind of what I focused on in my piece as well, specifically was about the ocean as like a sight of interspecies and intergenerational life, I think, just throughout history. Sorry?
Yeah, did you say more about the ocean? Because you bring up, like, also, like, transatlantic slave mm-hmm. trade, history of ocean as a site of trade and warfare.
Mm-hmm. I guess, well, I think about the ocean as a place where sea burials were once commonplace, you know, where many people have marked the passage of life of ancestors into the ocean, and it's only because of like colonial hygiene that we stopped that practice, although I'm sure that many cultures still do, and now because of that we've kind of uncoupled life and death, and I bring it up in the middle passage as well, specifically how people were violently thrown overboard or they willingly jumped overboard because they wanted to be with their ancestors. And actually bringing this up speaks to your piece on parasites, because the middle passage was a kind of vessel for disease because of the fact that colonialists packed the African slaves in such violent and unsanitary and overcrowded conditions, which basically became a breeding ground for disease and contagion. So I guess, especially if we, maybe I think back to your piece, how you talk about class divisions, which turn guest-host relationships into parasite-host relationships. I think about that too here, where, you know, like this concept of contagion, which comes from this, from touching, right? And like how some people are forced into positions where they have to touch, thinking about, you know, the pandemic as well, where not everybody was able to seclude themselves. Like some people still had to go to work, and the class divisions inherent in that type of segregation. So I guess I was, maybe you can speak too about your kind of transformation of the parasite from guest host to parasite and host.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought up those two ways of thinking of it that I kind of proposed lightly in this very short piece. Those two texts are really short, so it's nice to have a chance to sit with these ideas and talk about them. I kind of open, or soon after opening, bring up the movie Parasite, which I think is pretty important to a lot of people. The way that that movie frames the relationship of a wealthy family and the employees who work for them is that the employees sort of become like a barnacle mm-hmm. on their home and kind of like have a parasitic relationship to them, kind of stealing their stuff, gleaning the extras, easeling their way in, kind of like sneaking in, and then eventually hiding literally in part of the house, and like the resources of the house, the, you know, the invisible resources like energy and like light and heat. So it's a ironic and comic sort of reflection on the idea of the underclasses as parasitic. You know, I mean, that's the translated name, but I think it has kind of a consistent use across cultures in this particular case, the class relation is so often referred to as one in which the people who need care are those who are sucking resources from the common pot or tribute, but who take and who are not deserving of care because they're taking too much. And so this kind of like the language of the parasitic, I think, it's useful to look at what parasites really do in order to think what that language suggests. Most parasites are pretty harmless. We all are full of them. Yeah. Most of them are endemic. We'll never see them. Many things that we don't think of as parasites could be called parasites because they're living inside of us in a way that is advantageous to them. Parasites there a problem in the human body when there are too many of them, or if there's a particular species that a particular body isn't used to. And as you said, different bodies are used to different things, so traveling causes problems for people. But there's like I could just go on and on and on in terms of feminist discourse and stuff. I'll stop. But the idea that the parasite is like a negative or like a drain on the resources mm-hmm. is not true in terms of the way that ecosystems function, yeah. or at least the use of the term parasite is definitely not right. Most of
I think it was also potentially, well, there's probably many people have written about this, but I think that the term parasite could equally be applied to the wealthy family as well. I mean, you know, just think about throughout history, like really the true parasites are the colonialists and the imperialists who have ransacked land and labor in order for their own profit, right? And I think oftentimes we kind of bypass that kind of larger picture of a parasite because it's so completely out of grasp and inflect that word or apply that word to people that you can or like a community that really could benefit from being parasitic actually and you know enjoying whatever resources or trying to gain whatever resource they can to survive and actually thinking about the way that you've proposed parasite as just kind of like maybe a fact of life and not necessarily always being a bad thing reminds me of the relationship between this parasite that or rather a worm that has a relationship with a bacteria in the ocean that eats the bones of whales, right? But these two things need each other in order to survive. And you know, so this kind of interspecies mingling is something that you talk about a lot, I think, like this kind of embodying of the other, which you also spoke about in Erotic Rot, is, you know, a kind of thread that weaves through a lot of your work. How did you come to this as like a way of looking at relationships rather than them being, you know, one-sided or advantageous or not?
Yeah, I guess like it just goes to show that we tend to morally inflect non-human elements of ecosystems according to our own political desires and constructions. So the idea that the parasite is negative is interrelated with its use as an economic metaphor, mm-hmm. right? So you're totally, totally right, and I'm really glad you said that. It suggests coming from below rather than coming from above. And so there's kind of like this idea that it's like it's emanating from the earth, from the underground, from the hidden dark zones, you know, mm-hmm. there's this, it's really like a very stigmatized kind of language, which sort of tells you about like why are those bundle of terms or concepts like like why are they together? Well, because they're that is doing the work of mutual stigmatizing of various groups. Anyway, in terms of like interspecies mingling more generally, I guess I first became aware of parasites because a friend of mine suggested that my insomnia might be caused by like creatures in my gut mm-hmm. who have a different circadian rhythm than me staying mm-hmm. awake, which is just I would like to pause on, like, reflect on how wild and amazing that is. And I didn't know that much about circadian rhythms, but it turns out, like, your body is full of creatures with different clocks mm-hmm. than you, though most people don't actually have, like, a 24-hour clock, and that's kind of, like, a construction, too. Like, you know, you might have, like, a bacteria who operate on totally different timescales. That cycle might be totally different. Like we also learn about like die-off effects. Like if you kill like a lot of parasites mm-hmm. in your body, then as they die, they release certain chemicals that like make you sick, basically. So like the birth and death cycle of organisms within the human organism, as well as just the daily right. circadian cycle. Interesting. And it wasn't until I sort of had that image of like creatures with different like days and nights as my, like that you could have like nocturnal like parasites mm-hmm. is really, really cool. And it wasn't until that point that I started to really think about like, well, what did I think a parasite was?
Right.
Why didn't I know that I had them? You know, why is it such a body horror thing? Like parasites are like, that's terrifying to imagine these things like awake all
wriggling inside. Yeah.
Like it's like the baseline of body horror.
Yeah.
total. If anyone hasn't made a movie out of that, they should. And yeah, and so I guess I just got really, really interested in this idea of like, okay, why is it so horrifying to imagine something sucking off your resources?
Mm-hmm.
And that also like an idea I've inherited, and that maybe wouldn't be so horrifying if I didn't have such a fear of my own resources getting taken away.
Yeah.
I don't know. What do you think?
I think it's hard not to overlook the actual physical ailments that could come from, like, you know, having little parasites or bacteria or resistant to virus, right? Like, inhabiting your body. But I think it kind of, well, I sent you this question, kind of made me think of this idea of, like, extended kinship that we have with the little, like, little bacteria and microbiomes that are existing in our body. I guess how, if anything, can we use those relationships with our non-human kin, like whether they're toxic or not, how can we use them to resist or negotiate capitalist systems? Because I was thinking specifically about a piece which chronicled the life of this woman who has HPV, I think, HPV, and how through the virus inhabiting her body, she has actually, she's in kinship with Gilead, who produces the cure for her condition, basically. And the way that these like capitalist systems really enforce us to rely on them in order to cohabitate with human and non-human kin. So I guess I was thinking, how can we take hold of that as an anti-capitalist struggle, or like as a, you know, as a way to reclaim land that's been taken from us and taken from all the non-human species that we share the earth with. I don't know if you have any thoughts on that. That is a rambling question.
So I didn't read that you just mentioned, but the idea is that the person, most of us have HPV, but the person who has HPV who wrote this piece or was in this piece sees themselves as in kinship with the pharmaceutical company.
Yeah.
I think that makes sense. I mean, I was going to ask you about the word kin that you bring up
mm-hmm.
because it's such a like ubiquitous term now since Haraway brought it up however many years ago, and I found myself kind of thinking it randomly, and then I was like, what do I actually mean by that?
Yeah,
and it sounds good, like you know, and I think that the idea that like we're in kinship with pharmaceutical companies is really useful and towards bring that aim where we're just like, oh, we're all in kinship with
right.
nature, like and like, well, there's something like kin is not the same as ally,
no,
and I'm sure
not at all.
But I do think that like it's easy, like it's easy for me to be like, I'm, you know, I'm in kinship with my parasites, meaning like allies. I'm like, we're not allies, like
right.
we're not allies, like
right.
parasite doesn't have politics in the same way that I
right.
do.
I guess when I think about kin, I think because we relate that word so much to like love and chosen families and queer futures. I think that's the direction we hope that kin would go in, of course. But when I think of kin, I think of its possibilities of betrayal, right? And I know that Haraway specifically said kin is not kind. And when she said that, she specifically meant it in like the categorical sense, right? Like just because my cat is my kin, even though we're not of the same species. but I actually think of it in the emotional sense where kin can be considered in terms of acts of betrayal as well. And that we're all, like, we're also coerced into kinship, right, with entities that we don't necessarily want to be. So when I think of kin, it really does remind me of, like, the possible ways that we might do our best to operate under pressures of neoliberalism and capitalism and attempt to resist it within our own kin networks, whatever they may be.
Right. So nice about that example of being in kinship with the pharmaceutical company is, like, well, they're maybe not with the company unless the company is an entity, an individual, but maybe also the individuals who work in the company. Like, you know, that there are also people involved in the production of harmful chemicals and pharmaceuticals that help us, which we need because the environment has been so destroyed that it's hard to us. Like, the health-harm cycle is pretty tightly wound. But, yeah, the idea that there are, like, people also who you could be in kin with at a company, for instance. Like, and maybe, like, neither of us want there to be, like, a profit-making machine, like, that is, like, you know, exploiting our bodies for profit. But we're both, like, equally stuck.
Yeah.
And, like, there is this kind of, like, I guess, like, a political discourse that I'm probably referring to around, like, being, we're all compromised. So, like, what can we do once we've all been compromised? And, like, can assume that, like, a mutual state of being compromised could, like, allow us actually to act towards, like, you know, mutual good.
Yeah. If we can go back to your piece on Parasite for a bit, how do you imagine your relationship with Parasites to kind of, what direction do you see that going in now that you've ideated them as, like, kind of ambivalent, which is not, you know, not something that you necessarily want to get rid of, because, like you said, they release chemicals when they die. So how do you envision your future relationship with the parasites that exist in your body?
Well, personally, I did do a parasite cleanse, like, years ago, but kind of like a DIY one that was kind of, like, not very successful. I was just really afraid to get rid of them because, like, if you go into the parasite internet, man, I can, like, really recommend this to anybody who wants, like, weeks of, like, a frightening time. There's just really there are a lot of things you can do to rid your body of the parasites. And there are a lot of different theories about what ones you need and what ones you don't. And there are also theories about parasites that one might need to acquire. And this is like pretty common like discourse around like autoimmune conditions. Like they're kind of like people conjecture, and there's some evidence that, like, without certain parasites that humans evolved with, because we don't have them in certain parts of the world, environments are so clean that we develop an autoimmune response. Like, you know, very simply put, the body is attacking itself.
Right.
The component of the immune system is missing. Right. So then the parasite would actually be, like, a missing entity rather than an entity that, like, invades. Like, it would be something integral. I guess I went both ways. I was like, either I need to get rid of my parasites or I need more parasites. And I never really came up with the answer.
I guess you'll find out when you're lying awake at night and their nocturnal rhythms wake you up.
Certain that they're doing.
Speaking of that, I mean, I messaged you about the Bali Belly, which you bring up in the sense that you know, when foreigners travel to any country, usually in Southeast Asia or Latin America or South Asia, I always see this everywhere. Their biggest fear is getting Bali Belly, right? Like, their biggest fear is getting some type of parasite, which would ruin their vacation, I guess. But it also reminds me of malaria, which I was also telling you about, and how malaria or the parasite that was transported by the mosquito was actually a deterrent to European colonialism in the early ages, because so many people on so much of the, I guess, crew, or I don't know what you would call them, who were trying to colonize land basically became sick, and almost like 500 out of 1,000 men usually died from malaria. And it became basically, in if Europe and eventually the United States wanted to expand, they had to very quickly find a cure for malaria, because it was their biggest deterrent in colonizing land. So I guess really what I'm thinking of is, have you thought about the parasite as a potential or in relation to colonial history, histories of cleanliness and sanitation, and especially now that you've done like juice cleanses and things like that and raw diets, how do you envision that relationship of the parasite with colonialism and sanitation?
Oh, I'll just say there's no juice cleanse that will help with parasites. You have to cleanse that involve like walnut oil and clove oil, and that are very toxic to certain kinds of parasite larvae, but that's another story. Yeah, I think the connections you bring up make a lot of sense. Also just returning to what you were saying earlier about the Middle Passage and about the, you know, the transit of like, of germs around the world. I don't know if a parasite counts as a germ. I haven't thought of that. But yeah, I mean, Bali Bali is one word for it. Like Montezuma's revenge is, it's, you know, that's why it's called that. He's taking his revenge on you.
What is that? What is that?
That's like when you go, when a foreigner travels to Mexico and gets Bali Bali,
okay.
Basically. Yeah. It's basically like the usually drinking water can cause. I don't know what the... I don't know what the like organism is that causes the terrible consequences, but it's called Montezuma's Revenge because Montezuma, whose, you know, civilization was decimated by European germs, is getting revenge on you, the neo-colonizer, for coming and you know, going on a nice trip. And yeah, I actually think that that's quite funny that one entered like the common lexicon, mm-hmm. this like vengeful parasite. But it does suggest that, you know, we want our flora to be our allies. And like, I mean, I guess given like the history of like germ warfare, like it's really not a stretch, yeah. to try and think of them that way.
Yeah.
Maybe I've like, I would be interested to actually hear back to your piece on the videos there, because there's also like a pond in the mm-hmm. exhibition space. And what was that like? Was that like related? Was the liquid element related to what was happening in the videos?
I don't necessarily know that it was directly related, although I would create that relation myself simply because of how much water appeared throughout the videos. But projected off of it was the main video that was in the main exhibition space. So, I mean, I think that too, when I recall the water throughout the videos, I think then that kind of acts as like a passage between the two potentially, or a way to tie everything in together.
Mm-hmm.
That's why I honed in on the ocean so much, because like there's water everywhere. I'll go with this.
Seems like it. And it seems like, so also the video Songs for Dying, it includes imagery from protests, I think.
And, yeah, so.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
No, about the Jeju massacre, which I was shocked that I hadn't heard about, because mm-hmm. I guess it was.
I mean, it was silenced by the government. You know, they rallied for years to try and get the government to acknowledge it, but they wouldn't even do that. So I think, you know, when I think about the piece and its kind of recollection of personal memories, I think that's why it's so important that the political or the communal was included in that as well, because so often these things get lost in time, whether on purpose or not. And I think that the inclusion of the water too kind of does that, because the water naturally is like a site of life and death, right? It's like in constant circulation, where if you look at the ocean, it contains so many histories that we don't know about, don't think about, or have happened that we just choose to ignore. I mean, I think specifically about the migrant crisis, right? And the way that there's like a whole section of the ocean which basically whose sole purpose is to try and help migrants cross into Europe, whereas there's a, you know, that's like the invisible ocean, you could think of it that way, right? Where the visible part is used to carry goods and commerce, and the invisible part is where all the like policies which have inflicted so much violence on migrants lies, and they literally do at the bottom of the ocean. So that's what the inclusion of the political uprisings did for me in that piece, is that it forces you to remember these histories that really governments would prefer you not to, and the violences that they have enacted on communities. Yeah, and I think that it kind of flickers to the ancestral and the personal too. You know, these are like the people that are protesting are usually family from people that have passed away. So yeah, I mean, the personal is really communal, I think, ultimately, because we share so much of these histories, whether we know it or not.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess, I mean, part of the issue is trying to figure out ways the human collective could be broadened to think about the non-human as part of that collective. And I guess the first step for me is usually acknowledging that my own body is already a collective.
Yeah.
Parasites and others. And that, you know, so it's the first, like a deconstructing of the individual or the integrity of the bounded individual,
yeah,
that allows them to think about, you know, like myself as part of a collective that includes non-humans also.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's, I don't know. I hope that's the general direction that we are starting to trend it towards, is kind of thinking about these things as, well, like I said, right, like survivalist and poesis, really. But, you know, I think that we are at a stage where we're kind of accelerating towards, unfortunately, and this is probably pessimistic, like we're accelerating towards mass extinction and like severe climate change. I mean, I'm thinking specifically about the what just happened in Ohio, the train derailment in Ohio. But now, because I think really it's not we as individuals, it's like companies, for-profit companies are so unconcerned with the way that we are intrinsically tied to non-human species that they've allowed for this, I think it's called double death to occur, right? So like the first death is when the chemicals are used to kill pesticide is used to kill insects for crops, and then the second death is when you have occurrence like situations like this where chemicals and poisons are released into the ground, and then whatever species inhabit those ecosystems dies as well and continues to die because of you know, like we're just like engulfing, I don't know if it's a word, we're just ingesting each other, right? Or like species in the area are ingesting each other. So I don't know where I was going with that, but that's really the thing I've been thinking about recently, is like I hope that we get to a point where that relationship with non-humans extends beyond the individual, or like, yeah.
Yeah, I was also thinking about the Ohio catastrophe earlier in our conversation. I don't remember what I was going to tie it to, but just like this terrifying image of this like cloud. it's really stuck with me. I mean, I guess because I've written a lot about like toxicity and like,
yeah,
you know, like sort of there, you know, everything is toxic on one level. Like the idea of certain things being toxic versus clean or beneficial is like a cultural construction. Mm-hmm. I think that's true. I think like we're, you know, the construction of like what is bad versus good for us is often just, you know, like propaganda. but it seems like very clear that that cloud of like noxious chemicals above Ohio was toxic.
Yeah.
Like, and I was just first time like deconstructing that term, and I was like, no, this applies. Like, this
right.
is that.
Right.
Yeah.
But when does, I guess, how do you define that? Like, how do you pull away from labeling? When do you decide? How do you decide when things are toxic or not? And how do you apply that mode of thinking, I guess?
Yeah, that's a great question. I don't know. And I think everybody who has access to, like, the internet or news sources is, like, in a constant state of, like, minor panic about this, because it's really, really hard. Like, once I started thinking about, like, trying to have less of a certain kind of bad plastic in my home,
mm-hmm.
I think, you know, how much time trying to figure out how to get rid of it and what it was in. And it's in everything. It's in me. It's in the fish I eat. It's
mm-hmm.
in, it's so, so hard to start
yeah.
to try things. And I feel like being asked to do that also as, like, an individual slash consumer
yeah.
really
yeah.
like, it comes down to my consumption choices really sucks. Like,
yeah.
can I afford to buy certain kinds of vegetables? Like, it's all about, like, what you can afford to be without. And, of course, like, cleanliness
right.
is a privilege. But so privilege also becomes equated with cleanliness. And
right,
then,
right.
then that's where you have the pushback.
I mean, no, yeah. I mean, I just agree with you. I mean, that's really where... I think that's really where, like, contagion derived from, right? It's, like, this idea of the other as a contagion, literally as a contagion, as, like, a vessel for contagion, or, like, a cesspool for contagion, which then, of course, has led to xenophobic policies, which relate to the climate as well, in the sense that they're not distributed equally, right? Like, care is not distributed equally.
Will you remind me if we're so, like, when are we supposed to open to questions?
I think we can open to questions now, probably.
Okay. I didn't want to keep talking forever.
Well, you could talk forever if you like to. I'll listen.
Listen. Well, I guess we can just announce if anybody wants to ask a question.
Yeah. Does anybody have any questions? For either Elvia or mine's piece. Totally fine.
The 7-second rule, I was told once to wait 7 seconds, and after 7 seconds, I'll just keep talking. Okay,
no question.
Can we just talk about that word cesspool for a little bit?
Oh, yeah, sure. What do you have to say about it?
Well, I'm curious, because when I saw the image of this, like, lovely little pond in that exhibition, I was like, cesspool, or is that, like, a beautiful crystal clear pond?
It's a beautiful crystal clear pond. It's not a cesspool. But I don't know. I even have a problem using the word cesspool. Honestly, maybe I shouldn't have used that word. It just feels so pointed and, like, targeted. Yeah.
But it's a pretty interesting word. Now that I haven't actually thought about where it comes from. Like, clearly it's, like, a stigmatizing term.
Mm-hmm.
But
thank you, Sarah.
Bye. hi. We're still, okay. I thought she was saying that we have to go. No, I was just wondering where that word comes from. I don't even know what cess means.
I don't know. Don't ask me. I know what a pool is. That's all I know.
Yeah, look into that. Because there's something, I mean, it's like we're talking about, like, the ocean and, like, you know, like, lost histories being sunk down at the bottom of the ocean and contagion. And it's just like, yeah, you end up thinking of this, like, miserable, like, scary soup.
Mm-hmm. A scary soup that's in constant circulation.
Yeah.
Which we are further destroying. Yeah, I think I've been thinking about that because I've been reading about malaria quite a bit, and, like, because
that's
specifically,
breed.
Yeah, yeah, so because mosquitoes breed, or they breed in, like, yeah, cesspools. They breed in stagnant water, which actually people have been forced into contact with because of, you know, like land excavation and things like that. And it prompted segregation when the United States was trying to build the Panama Canal between the Black laborers and the West Indies laborers, you know, forcing them closer to these pools of water while making sure that they were kept far apart from it. And I think that kind of speaks perfectly to, like, the issues on, like, class issues that you talk about in yours, right? Like, these very apparent class divisions.
It's really fascinating. I guess, like, it's just like a very clear way of seeing how, you know, like, ecological devastation creates, like, mm-hmm. you know, it shifts the balance in favor of a certain species, and when balances shift, then, you know, diseases proliferate and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
What's the situation with malaria today? Is it?
I think it's still an issue. Interestingly, a lot of the research that is being done, being funded, is going to, of course, countries in the West who claim to work with local communities, but of course never do and never share their funding or their resources with the local communities that they say that they're helping. But that's why the invention of quinine was so important for European colonialists, because it made it possible for them to basically make the tropics habitable for white people. What they said is that they felt that their goal, their purpose was to make sure that the tropics, which they are not native to, could be inhabitable by them.
Mm-hmm.
That's the situation with malaria today. It's very treatable, but the resources are not equally dispersed, as with, you know, literally every other ecological or epidemic or pandemic that occurs today. It's just a maldistribution of resources.
Yeah, I guess, like, I just always think about, like, how, like, effective altruists are, like, they usually come down on mosquito nets being, like, the best bang for your buck.
Yeah.
Ways to save lives, maximum lives for maximum dollars.
Yeah.
Like, which I always think is really interesting. And then I also, like, of course, like, effective altruism is its own thing, but this idea of, like, a mosquito net versus, like, the medication needed to help people deal with malaria versus saying the final frontier is, like, the genetic engineering of mosquitoes so that they no longer breed, so the malaria goes away, in which case we lose. I think there's been, like, a fair amount of mainstream journalism around the, like, should we mosquitoes into extinction?
I've seen that too. No, I've seen it too, but I think that kind of speaks to your piece about parasites, actually, and, like, the, like, what is a good parasite, what is a bad parasite, does that even exist necessarily, right? It's like, because when you rid of a whole species, you rid of a whole orbit of species that basically relies on these things to function as they do. That's what I think.
Yeah, I mean, it seemed clear to me that, like, engineering a species to extinction was, like, not a good idea. And there was a fair amount of journalism that was like, yeah, we don't know, like, what would happen. We wouldn't be able to predict what would happen if we removed mosquitoes. But then it's like, it's just quite interesting because it's like the inverse of the question of, like, preservation.
Yeah.
it's like that we could engineer it either way. But, like, any engineering is, like, very, very difficult to do in terms of foreseeing the consequences. I just think, like, it's the language that, like, conservationists and preservationists use is the same language that people who want mosquitoes to go extinct use with, like, what's going to be beneficial for humans or cute animals that look like humans.
Right. I mean, that ties perfectly into this whole concept of other species, right? Is that you cannot speak for other species. We can't speak for non-human species. So everything that we're doing right now is, and it is affecting them in one way or another, right? But of course, there are species that are thriving right now. Like, I think the jellyfish is thriving despite coral reefs dying out. Like, interestingly, these are just cycles that we can't necessarily control. So yeah.
Yeah, say, jellyfish.
Say keep out of it.
Jellyfishes are an interesting, like, example, because they are thriving to the point in some places where there's so many of them on the surface of the water that the oxygen can't get to, you know,
the
creek below. Yeah. So, I mean, I don't know. Yes, there's no good parasite and no bad parasite.
There just are parasites, and we have to deal with living with them, I think. It's like, right, what is it? Oh, I actually have this quote by Jean-Luc Nancy, which I think kind of summarizes what we're saying, which is, being cannot be anything but being with one another.
Yeah.
Circulating in the with and as the with of the singularly plural coexistence. I think that summarizes it pretty well.
That's beautiful.
Well, thank you.
Yeah. Emmanuel Conchi has this, right, guy who wrote the Life of Plants, I think the book is called.
Mm-hmm.
And books, I can't remember which one is called what, but he calls it contiguous. He says that plants are the fundamental example of what it means to exist dependent on others and interdependent with others, because they're contiguous with their environments, meaning that they, almost all plants are rooted in some sense, and so dual in a way that other beings are not, like that they are entirely of their context.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't really need to use that word, but I think it's a nice way of thinking about why plants are special.
Yeah, I agree. I like
you
that too.
Use the word sympoiesis in your text, which is a way word. Is that how you say it? Sympoiesis?
I don't know. I say poesis, but I don't really know how to say it. Well, look to Haraway to figure out how to say it.
Yeah, I should watch her say it. she says it, like, in the same, like, probably in the same chapter as she talks about kin.
Mm-hmm.
First. But what does it mean to you?
Really, I think I still use it in the same way that Haraway does, right? And I think maybe potentially in the similar way that you do in when you talk about, like, enfolding of others, right? I don't think of it in a mutually beneficial way, in the same way that I don't think of kin as necessarily positive as well. But I kind of use that word to highlight our porous and boundaryless relationships to non-human species,
mm-hmm.
specifically because I think if we think about these relationships as like a leaking or contamination, that's that propels xenophobic ideas, right? And like of war and conquest, and that's why I much prefer to use sympoiesis, because it's like a way to counter the narrative of contagion and leaking. What about you? How do you think about it?
I don't know. I mean, I guess it's useful because, well, like, so an autopoietic system is like a system that perpetuates itself, I guess, and it, like, a cell is pretty much it. But even I just have a hard time thinking of anything that isn't sympoietic.
Yeah.
Like, even
I think,
yeah, the bio, I guess, like, the bio, we're taking the biological definition and sort of, like, using the term for something else.
I mean, I think it's especially hard these days to think of relationships in that way, simply because, especially here in the States, everyone, it's so individualized, right? Like, we are alienated from not just other people, but potentially from our own communities, and capitalism drives that, right? It's hard to think of things in that way, especially because it doesn't necessarily always make sense, because the relationships are not always great. But that, at least for me, it's helpful to be reminded of it, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I think, yes, they're not always great. I guess this idea of ambivalence in relation to parasites, but also ambivalence in relation to the idea of kin, is very useful.
Yeah.
And I feel like we could stop there.
Yeah, I think so too.
Summary moment. If anyone has questions, though, we can still.
Yeah. If anybody has any questions, we will wait 7 seconds, as Olivia says. That's the amount of time that you have to ask a question.
Send questions via DM if you have any.
Slide into the DMs, I guess.
Yes.
But thank you, everybody. And thank you, Olivia. Thank you so much.
Pleasure. Bye.
Bye, everybody.